This is a CNA podcast.
In a world driven by apps, almost everything is quantifiable. Our smartwatches tell us how many steps we've taken, how many calories we've burnt, and how much sitting we do. Now imagine applying this idea of tracking and quantifying to carbon emissions. Reducing emissions is no longer a suggestion, but a clarion call for countries and businesses as a key way to tackle climate change. But can emissions be tracked, quantified, or assessed in an objective and transparent way? And how will this affect decarbonization efforts? That's where innovative startups like Unravel Carbon come into the picture. Their aim is to help businesses track and reduce carbon emissions, and they use artificial intelligence to do it. But how does it all work, and can it really be foolproof? What are the deep challenges that come with tracking emissions, and at the heart of it, how does the world benefit? To have this conversation with me today are co-founders of Unravel Carbon, Grace Tsai and Mark Allen. Grace, Mark, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to see you, Grace. Great to hear from you, Mark.
Thank you.
You're joining us from Perth. So let's start at the beginning. While it's often labeled as a major risk, we know that climate change is also creating business opportunities. But I wonder why the focus on tracking emissions. Grace, let me turn to you first. You've been a serial entrepreneur, funding startups for more than 15 years. But why start your own business in climate tech, and why Unravel Carbon in particular?
Yeah, thanks for having us, Julie. So I'm a noob in climate change. I didn't even know what was the difference between net zero and carbon positive.
No way.
Yeah, just 18 months ago. So it's possible for any ordinary person to pick this up. I think my turning point came when I knew my second company was going to be acquired last year. And my daughter was just going to turn 2 years old.
Okay.
And when you have a child, you start to do things like wills and legacy planning. And when I was doing my will, there were some assets and properties that we're going to leave her. It suddenly just struck me that that's all well and good, but if I left her properties on a planet that is no longer going to be habitable by the time she grows up, what's the point of it all? And then I spoke to the 20 smartest people I know, reconnected back to Silicon Valley and Oxford where I studied. They pointed me to this whole area, very few companies measuring their carbon footprint, and even fewer are doing anything about it. And we have no time left in trying to decelerate the impacts of climate change. So I thought, using my tech startup and VC venture capital background, can I do something that is product-led, scalable, accessible, small and big companies can use to accelerate participation in the solution, rather than all of us being like passive bystanders.
Oh, wow. And one of those smartest people that you reached out to was Mark. Mark, you're
I'm not sure
chemical...
if I was in that group.
Very nice segue there.
But Mark, you are a chemical engineer with over 20 years experience and have been specializing in greenhouse gas and energy management. Why was it important for you to get involved in tracking carbon emissions?
My time in climate change and in climate strategy development goes back a long way, 15 years. I was actually working in the hydrogen industry at the time, back in 2004, and ran a hydrogen refueling station. And it was just this eye-opening moment where I had this realization that you could use chemical engineering skills for positive outcome. And I was like, oh, okay. Because in the university degree, we're not taught about sustainability. We weren't back then. And then did my research into sustainability and decided that of all of the very broad church that is sustainability and sustainable development, climate change is just one of those really, really big, really tough problems. And by and large, it's an existential problem for everything, right? So I'm like, oh, well, that seems to be like a really great area for me to devote my time into. At the time, I told my wife, I'm like, I'm going to pivot into climate change. And she's like, you know, there's a lot of money in engineering. Why would you want to do that? Now I'm vindicated 15 years later. Why emissions management? Because that's the basis of everything, right? So knowing your emissions and knowing your starting point gives you a way to plot a pathway to your endpoint, being net zero or climate positive or any one of the millions of buzzwords that float around at the moment. But you need to know where you start to get to where you need to be. And of course, the old adage, what gets measured gets managed at the end of the day.
All right, so let's just deep dive into how the platform actually works and what you guys are offering your clients. I visited your website, actually, and was quite intrigued by the mission statement. It said something along the lines of doing it in the 21st century way, automated, fast, and painless. Grace, tell us how tricky and painful it is to measure, track, and account for an accurate picture of the carbon emissions of a company, especially when you think about the intricate value supply chains as well.
We've started serving clients, even we're just less than a year old. And the clients who converted to us the fastest were the ones that have felt the most pain before. So they have worked with the best consultants, but the approach was still very manual, literally collecting paper invoices, electricity bills, reading the kilowatts from each one, putting into an Excel that Mark has used a million times. And that entire process can sometimes take up to 9 months in a year.
Wow.
Just to gather data in a non-automated fashion and to get the measurement out. And that just doesn't make sense, right? Then everyone is left with, what, 2-3 months to actually decarbonize?
That's a good point.
And then it's the next financial cycle already. So I think Unravel really wants to take that problem by the horns and reverse the effect-impact ratio. So now we're specialized in converting any company's accounting data because that's their richest source of truth. A lot of people spend time preparing their financial data, and we convert that into carbon data in seconds.
Wow. So, Mark, is it as easy as uploading files in the platform? And how accurate is it? And can it really be foolproof?
From a user point of view, yes, it's absolutely as easy as uploading a file to the platform. Behind the scenes, obviously, there is a lot of work that goes on to get to this point. So a lot of very rigorous data science, a lot of collecting high-quality data, machine learning, and then improving our data sets over time as more and more users come onto the platform as well. So I guess a swan, all calm on the surface, but going a million miles an hour underneath just to make sure that everything is robust and scientifically sort of useful to provide high-quality information that clients can actually make decisions from. So in terms of accuracy, what we're doing is certainly a lot better than the norm, right? Because I've been doing these emissions inventories for quite some time, and particularly when we start talking about supply chains and indirect emissions, so the emissions associated
with
the things...
Which we specialize in, Scope 3.
So the emissions associated with the things you buy or the things you do, and your products do downstream, right? They've typically been very inaccurate, using really high-level factors that say when you spend a dollar on food, that's equal to X number of kilos. And all food is plugged into the same bucket, whether it's a dollar on beef.
Which doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah. Correct. Whether it's a dollar on beef or a dollar on kale, same outcome. And it doesn't make sense from a decision-making point of view because the only way to reduce your emissions is to spend fewer dollars. There should be actually actionable insights where we can go on an item basis and say, well, actually, if you bought this thing from this other person or if you replace this item with something else that's similar, then there's a way for you to reduce your impact.
Interesting. So, Grace, I wonder how many companies are you currently working with? Who's your target clientele? And sort of which sectors are you seeing most traction and demand?
Wow, great questions. There are 12 major sectors globally, and we are building engine by engine. So we have 12 engines to build, but the algorithm is actually the same at the core of it. But the data, the pricing, the items, the emission factors differ sector to sector. The first sector that we chose to build for is in food and agri. Because if you take a step back, the 5 highest emitting industries in the world are, of course, petrochemical, then food and agri, built environment, transportation, logistics, and fashion.
I see.
So we chose food and agri. We took 4 months to build the first engine, and it's now done. So now we can serve anyone, starting from seed propagation, whether it's vertical farms or landfills, all the way to final use, restaurants, hotels. The second engine that we are 95% done is to serve e-commerce platforms. So that's why we're talking to Redmart and Lazada, and we're talking to Carousel and Grab and all these wonderful unicorns, right? Because the leaders helming these companies are very progressive. Right. They don't need much convincing to know that this is the right thing to do. Although they are not yet asked by any stock exchange or anything to do that. Some are. Some of our clients are public listed. I think in terms of traction, I would say that the tech sector is responding a lot faster. Sometimes within 2 weeks from the demo, they already want to sign up on our platform. For example, Salad Stop, Temasek Bank, Asia's largest salad chain, they're opening the first net zero branch in Capital Spring on Monday as a net zero branch, the first ever net zero outlet.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and Unravel is the data platform behind, and the leaders at Salad Stop, Adrian and Catherine, it's in their DNA to do the right thing, and they're manifesting that through everything they're building. So that's a great example. We could even see that their highest emitting ingredient was the feta cheese. They get to innovate. Do they replace the feta cheese? Do they find from a local supplier? So it gets more fun from a decision-making point of view.
Mm. And Mark and Grace just mentioned the food and agri sector, but you guys are also looking at fashion. Why fashion? How would it work in that industry?
It's very tough.
Yeah, fashion is a big impact industry. So as Grace pointed out, on balance, when we add up all of the indirect emissions and the direct emissions from the industry, it is a large emitter. And of course, fashion itself is this sort of high volume product, for better or for worse. That is just the society that we're in at the moment. And on top of that, fashion supply chains have typically been very, very opaque. So really hard to get any decent information, anything past your sort of first level suppliers. So we're hoping that by leveraging technology, we can actually shine some light into those areas and look at some of the true emissions impacts of the fashion industry and then help them decarbonize, make smarter decisions around their supply chains and see benefits overall.
Hi, I'm Adrian Tan.
And I'm Crispina Robert.
We are the host of a new podcast called Work It.
We're here to get into the essential things that no one tells you about working and company culture, from office politics to dealing with burnout.
If you've ever wanted to eavesdrop on an interesting conversation by the water cooler,
this podcast is for you.
Look out for our episodes wherever you get your podcast.
So it's not just Salad Stop. I mean, you mentioned a few tech companies as well. Recently, we've been seeing the number of companies with net zero emission targets surging around the world. Are you sensing there is that tectonic shift on the ground as to how companies are viewing their carbon footprint and their desire to reduce them?
So we group our leads. We're talking to over 100 live leads right now into two buckets. One bucket is they respond because it's regulatory pressure, right? So they're responding because it's compliant to. The second bucket is from voluntary pressure. These companies are responding because they know and believe fundamentally that's the future of business. And they know that's the right thing to do. I think everyone is on their own journeys. I think as long as you get started, that's good. So we definitely see a lot more happening on the ground. But Asia, in general, lags behind.
Would you agree, Mark? What's your observation? Is there still resistance with companies opting to stick to their old ways? And given that the transition towards net zero can be disruptive, sometimes expensive.
There's a little bit of that going on. There's certainly a little bit of trying to maintain the status quo. And that's natural. That's change resistance of any organization. And I've been doing this for 20 years. Why would I need to change? Why do I need to do things differently, etc.? In my experience, when I started in climate change in 2007, you really couldn't talk about climate change to people. And in fact, all of the conversations I would have were framed around, oh, we can save you energy and save you money. And then as a byproduct, obviously emissions reduce because you're reducing your energy consumption. That has changed completely. And in the last 18 months, everyone's talking about emissions and net zero targets and decarbonization. I feel led largely by the finance industry because finance industry's gone, oh, all of our money is tied up in the status quo. And that status quo has got to change. So how do we know whether that money is at risk long term?
Right.
Particularly institutional investors investing for like 20, 30 years in pension funds. So that's caused a huge shift. Now, the step that we need to take now is moving on from making a commitment to net zero, right? And I was on a panel recently, which was really enlightening because this guy who was on the panel said, we've set a net zero by 2050 target. But he said, what's important is we've also set an actual emissions reduction target for 2025. And I'll still be working here in 2025, so I've got to deliver that. I don't have to deliver a 2050 target because that's 20 years away. I'm not going to be here. But the important thing is now this roadmap. How are we actually going to achieve that? What are the points along the way and how do we set those interim targets, which is something now that companies are grappling with, countries are grappling with.
Yeah,
2050 is 10 prime ministers away. It's, you know, 5 CEOs. A lot can change in that time.
And 90% of global GDP, economies of global GDP have pledged. But we have to already move away from promises and pledges to the other P, which is the actual pathway, the plan.
I like
so
the
all
P.
These pledges are there, but they are looking for solutions like ours and others to create the other P's.
The carbonization movement, so to speak, has led to many other startups that promise to help companies track, reduce, and offset their emissions as well. A real booming market out there, which means some tough competition for you guys. There are those who are even offering the service for free. How is Unraveled Carbon trying to stay ahead of the game?
We are a SaaS plus service model, so our clients don't just get thrown with a platform. They still get Mark's team specifically to handhold them and guide them. We have just raised Asia's largest seed round ever for a climate tech platform.
Congratulations.
That's part of the moat. We get to get the best talent on board. Like, we have 30 people now. A bulk of them are software engineers, data scientists, data architects, PhDs that are reading the most advanced research papers on how to apply machine learning on climate change. We are talking about building the best climate tech platform out of little Singapore with the best talent possible globally. We're hiring from all around the world. So I think at the end of the day, it's our people that will be our greatest defense. But having said that, the more they are, those that are at least doing it properly with a lot of scientific backing, the better. Competition or collaborators, we don't really mind as long as more people are helping tackle this problem.
So against a more of a wider landscape when it comes to carbon emissions, I want to get your thoughts on carbon offset. Right, because I'm sure your services give companies the option to offset their emissions. There's been quite a heated debate about whether it really works. Is it just a distraction? Does it enable polluters to continue polluting? Where do you stand on this, Mark? Does it have a role to play? Do you have any plans to collaborate with, I don't know, offset project developers maybe? Your thoughts?
Yeah, I have many thoughts about offsets, as Grace knows. But as a principle within Unravel, we are always reduce first. This is a good general principle for use of offsets, right? So it should be, you need to do as much as you can with the sort of funds and resources you have available to reduce your own emissions, both yourself and within your supply chain, before you then use offsets for residual unavoidable emissions, as sometimes termed. And the reason for that is there's just not enough offsets to go around. And there won't be enough offsets to go around. And in the future, limited supply, huge demand, the price will go bananas. And that's just the market at the moment. So pinning your entire corporate strategy on buying offsets ad infinitum is not really an amazing strategy going forward, because you'll just find yourself exposed to pretty high costs. Now, offsets themselves are actually really useful. The thing that we have to just keep considering is, are they high quality offsets? Are they real emissions reductions? Are they permanent emissions reductions? Are they timely? So you're not buying offsets from some refrigerant destruction project in 2007 and they've got the right vintage. And of course, they're additional. So it's emissions reductions that wouldn't otherwise have happened in without the offset. So with the right governance processes, offsets are really, really useful. Now, one of the issues has been sort of a tendency for it to be a bit like the Wild West in some ways, and some crazy projects and some less than reputable registries turning up, but that will get filtered out as users of offsets become more aware. Now, the one interesting thing that's happening at the moment is now this divergence between avoidance and removal offsets, right? So offsets generated for emissions that were reduced against some baseline, or those that actually remove CO2 from the atmosphere, and you see someone like Stripe recently spending $600 a ton, which is right at the top end of what one would pay for direct air capture, to try and promote that industry and scale that up.
And Grace, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just have one line to add to Mark's very detailed analysis, which is Unravel is an offset last platform, not an offset first platform that many other platforms are.
Fantastic. Would it have any impact on greenwashing? How seriously are you looking at that challenge?
But that's the thing. We don't want any sloppy pathways because that's slippery. We want proper reduction, right? Part of the second engine we haven't talked about is a solutions recommendation engine. That's also maybe one of the first in the world that exists, where we automatically recommend a decarbonization pathway for our clients based on their data. And because we have done a lot of user discovery, we have pre-packaged these pathways into lowest cost, lowest effort, most urgent, highest ROI, and try to bring in that consumer flavor into an otherwise very deeply scientific enterprise platform. So hopefully our clients are going to implement what we recommend, both from the engine and our sustainability consultants, and really only use offsets as the final move for unavoidable emissions, not for emissions that they can avoid by reducing.
Point taken. And Grace, you know, looking ahead now, you've set some ambitious goals of removing 1 gigaton of carbon emissions, or 5% of the global target by 2030. Wow, that's ambitious. How are you planning to successfully scale up your operations to achieve this?
Well, we want to be the default decarbonization platform for any companies in Asia to use. That's why we are measuring our own success with our client success in removing emissions. So the 1 giga is through the work, the reduction work of our clients and their supply chains. We just want to own Asia as a geographic market, but the way to scale is that we want to get deeper and deeper into the supply chains of our clients. So our client has the best incentive to want to get the original carbon data from their suppliers. And these suppliers are also incentivized to remain a vendor or a supplier to our customer and therefore have to respond to this request. There's no point us or even anyone else asking suppliers to disclose these things because it's not something that they think about. But when the pressure is applied by the Grabs, the salad stops of the world, then the vendors will respond. So that's our plan to scale. We go deep. But having said that, we have opened our New Zealand as a second market, and Mark and I will be in Sydney in the next 2 weeks to also explore the Australian market.
Exciting times. So before we let you to go, perhaps a final word on how tech can help with climate change and where do you see it headed? Mark?
Oh gosh, tech is for me this way to achieve that scale. One of the things that I really love about Unravel Carbon is the fact that it can take what I was doing as a consultant and just do more of it quicker because consulting is a little bit unscalable. There's only a finite number of hours in the day currently. One day tech will be able to solve that too, maybe. But you can only work with a certain number of clients at one time. It can only deliver the certain amount of work at one time. So leveraging technology to do all of this grunt work and then leaving people with more time to do the fun strategy and the decarbonization implementations, that's really where I see it going and why technology is really important.
Thank you. And Grace, your outlook of climate tech landscape?
For me, technology enables us to think the unthinkable and to hope the otherwise impossible. Many years back, we would not think that we are streaming music from anywhere or playing multiplayer games with people around the world or watching people play games through YouTube, right? Or having a global e-commerce economy or having a social network that transcends geographies and borders. Technology enabled all of that. We would not have otherwise thought we could do get all those things. So the same with this. Climate change is a long, old, stubborn problem. It's time that speed and scale are introduced into it, but also to make it sexy, to make it fun, to make it painless. That's the only way that the human behavior will want to do something. They wouldn't do it if it's difficult and laborious and expensive. So hopefully we're onto something here.
Hopefully. Thank you so much, Grace. Thank you very much, Mark. Thank you both for joining in. Best of luck in your efforts. And hopefully we'll see general progress in the fight against climate change. Thanks to my guests, Mark Allen and Grace Tsai. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And do remember to subscribe and like this podcast so you know when a new episode drops. You can find CNA's climate and sustainability coverage online at cna.asia. The team behind this podcast is Jacqueline Chan, Audrey Wan, Daniel Lee, and Crispina Robert. And I'm Julie Yu, signing off.